Welcome back to the Sentientism podcast, a podcast about what's real and what matters. Sentientism answers those two deep questions by committing to using evidence and reason and having compassion for all sentient beings, including the one chewing my toes at the moment. In this episode, I talk to Christoph Dont. Christoph is a social psychologist and senior lecturer at the University of Kent, where he runs Shark Lab, a group focused on the study of human intergroup and animal relations. He's the author of the book, Why We Love and Exploit Animals. It's a fascinating conversation. I'd love to know what you think of this episode and the podcast as a whole, so why not write us a review or give us some stars on your listening platform? Every share, review, and rating helps us nudge a few more of the 7.7 billion remaining people towards more compassionate, rational thinking. You can find out more about sentientism at sentientism.info or just search for sentientism on your favorite social media platform. You'll be made welcome in any of our global community groups. They're open to anyone interested in these ideas, not just sentientists. Thanks for listening. So good morning, Christoph. How are you?
Good morning, Jamie. Yeah, thanks for inviting me. I feel great, yeah.
Good. It's a pleasure to have you on Sentientist Conversations. Thanks for making the time. As we've discussed before, this is a series of conversations about the two deepest philosophical questions, what's real and what matters, and really taking people through a personal philosophical journey as to how they grew up thinking about those two deep questions and where they've got to now in their lives and what those implications might be for the future. And I'm asking those questions with an obvious bias, which is in the title of the YouTube and the podcast, because I'm trying to popularize and develop this, a modern recasting of this idea of sentientism, which is a very simple worldview that just says, when it comes to what's real, we should take a naturalistic approach using evidence and reason to build probabilistic and provisional beliefs about the world with humility and uncertainty embedded. And when it comes to what matters morally, the clue is in the name. We should have compassion. We should include in our moral consideration all beings that have sentience, that have the capacity to experience suffering or flourishing. But in these conversations, I'm talking to people who agree and disagree with the tenets of sentientism. So it'll be fascinating to see where the conversation goes. But before we get into those two questions, how, for people who don't know of your amazing work already, how would you best introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm a social psychologist and a senior lecturer in psychology at the University of Kent, and also doing lots of research on how you relate to animals, how humans perceive and relate and behave towards animals. And that includes also meat consumption. I will link into other psychological processes from social psychology and intergroup relations. So we try to do a psychological intersection between sexism, racism, and speciesism as well. So we link it all up in our research to see how these different types of ideological belief systems are interconnected. And then we have specific research projects on how people are biased in their thinking about animals and how they are evaluating their own meat consumption habits, trying to do some intervention studies as well. Like we focus more and more on how to change people's behaviors or change people's views as well. So that's a broad summary of what I've been doing research-wise as well.
That's great. Fascinating. Yeah, and we'll come back to that work later on because I know you've listened to a few of these conversations. That's one of the central challenges is us humans are pretty weird. So understanding both how we interact with non-human animals and other human animals is a fascinating topic that I think you can help us delve into.
Yeah, and that's where it sometimes conflicts with what you're trying to do based on reason and science. And then psychology is there. That's, yeah, we are not rational decision makers. No one is like really following. It's a mix of distorted thinking about the world with normative kind of cultural norms embedded into that. And then emotions and all blends together to end up doing what you're doing. That kind of complex system makes it hard to approach everything from that the rational approach and trying to understand it will learn us how to trying to address this as well.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's one of the toughest things about having a naturalistic worldview is you need to be skeptical of your own ability to be rational. And that's a mistake that many people make is thinking we're more rational than we really are. So we can always aspire to do a bit better, but yeah, we need to understand the reality of what we are, how we evolved, and the limitations of our own ways of thinking as well. That's one of the things your work digs into.
Yeah, totally. And it's also about, even if you make up your mind from a very logical perspective, based on science and reason and everything, it doesn't necessarily lead to practical tools that might have an impact on other people. On if you take average person, you have all these other influences on that, and just reasoning and like logical thinking doesn't necessarily lead kind of to behavioral change in for most people. So we need to consider a number of these different factors. We know from psychology that this, it's very hard to change people's behavior if you want to push them to being more sentient, or like in terms of, or being more supportive towards the ideology of sentientism and act in that way.
You're suggesting that just listening to this YouTube or podcast won't convince everybody we're right. That's very disappointing to hear.
It might help for some, it might help for others. Yeah. I don't think one way works for everyone anyway.
I agree. And I think we'll absolutely come back to that. And before we get onto some of those questions, it would be good to understand your own personal philosophical journey. And the first question I like to ask is, what's real about the universe? And for many people, that's a conversation about whether they grew up in a sort of naturalistic, atheistic family and society and environment, or whether they had a more spiritual or religious, supernatural worldview, and how that side of their thinking has shifted over time, if it has. So, yeah, you can go back as far as you like and tell us as much or as little as you like about that story.
Yeah, so I'm originally from Belgium, right? And Belgium is a pretty Christian country.
Yeah.
Catholicism is the dominant religion, but not that practiced in terms of religiosity. So there's a lot of kind of non-practicing Catholics. They would identify themselves as Catholics, but not really that engaged in what's happening in the church, and that faded away across time as well. So, but my parents raised me with these Christian values of compassion and respect for others, yeah. and also like more traditional family values. So I went along and they went to church and myself as well when I was like early teenagers, and until I started questioning a number of these things and couldn't find myself in that anymore. So became quite strongly atheist then. Like, this didn't make sense to me anymore in terms of not the values, because I took the values on board, but that those values that I just mentioned are like also found it back in other religions and then in humanism as well. So there's a lot of common ground there between different world religions, and you can take these values along and act upon it and try to live to consistent with those values without having to take everything else with it. Even though I was strongly against religions shortly after that, like I think this was one of the major causes for all the problems in the world.
Yeah.
But I don't...
That's one of the common themes that comes through quite a lot of these conversations, is people will move away from a religion and then go through quite a militant atheist phase. And some people stay in that and others don't. But was that decision in your teenage years to say, well, I'm no longer a Catholic or a Christian, was it more fact and evidence and reason and doesn't feel like it's true? Or was it there are some ethical aspects of this religion which I disagree with, or a bit of both? It feels like it was more of the former. Like,
no, it was a bit of both. Yeah, like I started to really realize the fundamental problems with Catholicism as well, and the religion and as an institution. And there are still huge problems with that. And then the more you dig into it, the more nasty stuff. And then if you read the Bible, it's full of sexism and racism and all of that. So yeah. I couldn't, like, and you can't really deny that. Like, it's there. And then you can try to give it a different interpretation. But then if you look at Bible studies as well, like, it's been rewritten and it's all... Yeah. And it felt so fake. And that's where the logic comes in. Like, this doesn't make sense to me. This is not where I want to. I can still take those values on board, but those values are valuable and for their own sake and not because of the religious background of it. Right. So, and then you move towards humanistic values anyway, and humanism. And then that's where I stayed, really, even though I would not identify myself as I'm humanist or like this. I'm just identify as an atheist now.
Yeah. And has your sort of militancy about religion and atheism softened and moderated, or do you still see religion generally as, you know, roughly negative force in the world? Or
I don't think so. I think there are, it did soften along the way. And this is not, that doesn't have to be the main focus of kind of what we need to address to improve the world. There's a lot of belief system, whether they are religious or non-religious in the world, that have good and bad elements to it. So what can we do to find common grounds then and push people into the good direction without taking away the religion? Because I have come to believe that it's just impossible to take away, and it's even counterproductive to take away a lot of the traditions that people value. As long as these traditions are not harmful to others or to other groups, it's completely, even though it doesn't make any sense to that to me sometimes, like it's not logical, or it's just cultural norms and traditions that are there and we follow them for some reason. And this is stronger in more like for religions, there's all these symbolism that do not make sense to me, but that's completely fine as long as they're not harmful for others. If people find their value in there, and then the sense of community, the sense of belonging, the life satisfaction, it's like that's not the core problem. The core problem is that institutionalized religion where power is being abused, and all where when it's directed or leads to hate towards other religions, right?
Yeah, and I share that view as well, because these ideas and ways of thinking have got such resonance and such power for people, and there's a lot of value there for many people. But to me, I agree, a dividing line is where harm is caused, either to people outside of the group or often people within the group that are oppressed or harmed by some of those beliefs. And it's, again, I think you and I probably agree, and there's a lot of really strong, powerful compassion in almost every religious way of thinking, and that commonality, ideas like the golden rule, are there partly because I think they're just good ethics and people like to live in a community where suffering is seen as a negative thing to needlessly cause, but also because I think those positive, compassionate ethics and the ability to cooperate predate all of those religions as well. You know, I don't think there was any sort of perfect proto-evolved morality, right? There's no moral structure embedded in nature or evolution, if you like. But even before humans, non-humans have some form of proto-morality that's based around kin dynamics and reciprocity and the fact that cooperation can benefit the individual, right? So there's some rudimentary ethics there already. And one of the interesting things is that it feels to me that because that you don't really need the supernatural beliefs to justify a compassionate ethic at all, but it feels to justify some of the more warped ethics, that's where you sometimes do need a higher power or a supernatural rationale to justify why you would exclude compassion from a particular group or why you would justify harming or killing. So it's an interesting mix there. But ultimately, I agree. I think personally, I have a naturalistic approach that is very broadly compassionate, but I'm absolutely welcome broad compassion, whether or not the motivation is supernatural or not, as long as that supernatural way of thinking or religious way of thinking isn't causing harm to others or people within the group, then that's absolutely fine. But I mean, a diversity of views and opinions is important. And was that shift, I guess, intellectually, emotionally, and socially difficult, or was it quite easy for you? Because for some people, I grew up in quite a gently religious background as well, so it wasn't a traumatic thing to give up for me. But some of my other guests, one of the guests, John Adeniti, probably is one of the strongest examples, where he was a Sunday school teacher in a Nigerian evangelist church, and his entire society and family was deeply bound up in the church, and his process of leaving that religious organization was much more challenging. Where was your experience on that spectrum? Was it challenging or easy?
The school that I went to in secondary school was a Catholic school, but also there they're very open-minded about everything there. So we did have kind of these traditions to follow. Like everyone is doing that because it creates community. But that was not like super rigid or super strict in any sense. And a lot of the situation in Belgium is that kind of some of the Catholics still are better schools than the non-religious schools. So a lot of non-religious people go to these schools anyway. I think the Catholic and Christianity on board with that. And everything is approached from a pretty open mind there as well. So not super, the differences between schools, but at least I can talk about my own school there. So it did lead to a few conflicts because I was not the most well-behaved kid in school anyway, also not for my parents, because when I was going through like 14, 15 years old, I was upset with the entire world and society. So the religion was only one aspect of it. But then on top of that, it became, capitalism, that doesn't seem to be my thing either. And just the whole society, how much immense amount of suffering that has caused, and then veganism came on top of that, right? Like soon after. And this, yeah, we need to have a very active counterculture now, and we need to change things because this is not right. So I was angry with the world all the time. And during my teenage year, I was super active. I wanted to do it. Like, I couldn't deal with authority in terms of teachers questioning everything, basically. I always wanted to question everything. Like, why are we doing this? This doesn't make sense. This is just in place to keep injustice going now. And we need to, like, why are you trying to restrict people's freedom, but also in a way that caused so much harm and inequality in the world? That's where I try to understand the world, and also push me to the study of human behavior and human thinking. And why are people doing what they're doing? That doesn't make sense to me. And how is it rooted in this kind of systems of injustice and belief systems, ideologies that do not feel right, but you can also reason that they are not right. That leads to a lot of harm and suffering in the world. And yeah, so realizing that was on the one hand liberating, but I'm also raised in a household that was very caring and very supportive. It did lead to a number of conflicts, but my parents have always been very supportive to my activities as well. So even though they had a huge number of concerns with some parts I took, and so they were more supportive towards other parts I took or activities I was involved in. So I did keep them awake at night from time to time because they were concerned about what I was doing. But yeah, that's also pushed me into kind of this study of like social psychology of human behavior and all these kind of things that come with it.
You can see the track. So you went from being a troublesome student to being a teacher and an academic. So.
Yeah, it seems like a number of academics have a bit of that, like in social psychology or in social justice research or in sociology, have a bit of that same kind of background, not always identical, but at least they're trying to do something meaningful in terms of their career or in terms of their job as well, and trying to put their energy in that to keep on going what they actually believe in, but also understand it better and see how you can actually systematically address this problem rather than being a teenage troublemaker.
And there's been a number of the people I've had the privilege of talking to so far would probably fall into this camp of sort of activist academics. They really want to understand the world, but they want to change it too. But you've already hinted at maybe some answers to the second deep question, which is what matters morally. And you talked about harm and justice and freedom. And one of the reasons that some people are hesitant of moving away from a religious worldview is because they're nervous that they'll lose their moral grounding. You certainly don't feel that. And in fact, it was your sort of, I guess, to some degree, your ethics and your morality that led you to challenge religion in the first place. Neither you or I have a supernatural worldview. So in the absence of some sort of perfect deity or a book of rules that tells us what good and bad are, how would you describe the grounding of your morality, if there is such a thing?
It's a hard question, right? Like a lot of it is also going with what you feel is right and what is like with your own moral intuitions. And it's hard to completely understand that and bring that, to kind of express that in words. But it's about, for me, it has always been about freedom and equality, like generally speaking, the two pillars there, typically associated with a super left-wing view, but I don't think that should be in that left-wing corner. It's like it's what feels right for most people, and where actually there's common ground that people think it should be. Like, we need to strive in as much as possible to make a just society in terms of trying to have freedom and also equality, but that comes with responsibilities and accountability as well. And then how to structure society around that differs massively depending on some political beliefs. But yeah, those kind of other things that like people would intuitively, most people would intuitively support those kind of values. No one likes, like, and that comes with avoiding harm to others. Like, everyone would say we should not let other people suffer. And when is someone suffering is when they feel pain, when they are sentient and they understand that they feel pain. So even like intelligence levels do not really matter now. It's really about being able to experience pain and suffering and a wide range of emotions there as well. That feeds into that. That's the things that we need to care of and avoid.
Yeah, thank you. And in a way, I sometimes get nervous that I lead everything back to sentience, right? Just because I'm focused on this way of thinking. But terms like justice and freedom and equality are very common in people's intuitions about what's morally right about the way we should organize a society and the way we should choose how to act personally. But quite often, even those things for me come back to the reason why freedom is important is because most sentient beings enjoy being free. So in a way, even some of the quite deep concepts like freedom to me are ultimately justified because of their impact on the quality of the sentient experience, whether they cause suffering or flourishing. But no, that's a useful sort of flavor of what you think is right and wrong and why. And part of the journey here is, I think you're right, many people would share those values. And actually, I think many people, as you say, would share those values even across the political spectrum as well. There's radically different views about, okay, how can we make the world more just and free and equitable? People will have visceral disagreements about the best way of doing that, but many people would share those views. But critically, when they're thinking about harm and compassion, people will constrain or make that compassion conditional in various ways. And it would be interesting to know your own journey on that front too. So typically, we'll be brought up as children and we'll naturally feel a sort of compassion and affinity for our family and then our friends and our wider social group. We might develop, as you mentioned, a sort of humanistic, at least conceptual, compassion for all humans, regardless of other characteristics at some point. And another critical point in the journey for you and me is also recognizing that, okay, non-humans matter morally as well. It would be interesting to know that side of your story. At what point did some people don't like the term moral circle, but whether it's a, you know, scope of moral considerability, how did that shift over time and how did those realizations drop in?
Yes, there were some critical, like, eye-opening moments there anyway, so that you start to feel very disturbed at what's going on in the world with animals as well. And then you start realizing, wow, this is something I haven't thought about before, and this is radically changing my worldviews as well. And then that was just, I think I was 14, 15 years old, I always cared about animals generally, but... We have these inconsistent attitudes, like also what is documented by the meat paradox. Like we don't want to harm animals, but at the same time, it's always been in our culture, in our traditions, and we love eating them or using their products or use them for entertainment for all this wide variety of reasons.
And did you have companion animals at home? Was that part of?
I had cats, yeah, and at that point, and I recognized them as sentient beings, but that's kind of part of the speciesism structures, right? Like we like our companion animals, we see them as family members, but we don't attribute the same kind of characteristics or moral value to farmed animals, or we don't even want to think about them as animals when we kind of, because you learn from an early age that these are being raised for food, so their only function is kind of food, which at some point you realize it does make sense, right? These are sentient animals with their own personalities, with their own feelings and desires, and they're just put away in these factory farms or other farms, and it just doesn't feel right. But then the critical moments that I felt like where I felt disturbed was when I saw my grandfather slaughtering the chickens or the bunnies that he was raising himself, and so they had relatively good life and like just in the backyard, but then all of a sudden they've been killed, and I witnessed that. It's like that felt very disturbing to see that happening. And then you see, well, actually, this is how meat is being produced generally, even in a lot worse circumstances. So then moving on, like when I became more familiar with the hardcore punk scene, when you were vegan straight, which was a big thing, and Belgium had a huge movement there in the 90s. So we got all these vegan bands playing, and they're like, their lyrics were like very explicit about what happens to animals. I think like the music scene is a bit more quiet about it now, but bands are not speaking too much about these topics anymore. Some do, but not all of them. Like, but back in the '90s, like all bands had a pretty clear political message there, and a number of these bands were clearly on animal rights as well. And
straight edge is a fascinating movement. I wasn't too aware of it at the time, but you intuitively don't think of punk bands as being the most compassionate groups of people, right?
Yeah, well,
so it's an interesting combination.
Yeah, you can't blend it all together. I could go on for hours about the hardcore punk scene and how it actually distinguished from punk, the 70s punks, and that was the positive youth movement that kind of try to do something constructive in society, but still super DIY. And if you want to make it, you need to do it yourself. Let's build a community. And in the 90s, that was also pushed a bit back against kind of the more pessimistic, like definitely the punk from the 70s, super like no future type of thing. But then also the grunge was pretty depressive. I love grunge music, but when it became very political in hardcore punk and the metalcore scene, it was like, oh yeah, this is really want to make a difference here in society and not just for the community itself, which was already great to have it. And they, like that scene or that movement really connected with animal rights activism, with the peace movement, with like all kinds of activism, anti-fascist movements, were trying to influence other kids doing something meaningful with your life. So that's where when we went to shows, there were benefits the money went to charities, animal charities, that type of thing. Like there was always a purpose there. And that's how you learn about it. They had the animal rights organization with their flyers and their booklets, and everything was still on paper. Internet was not... was not the best source of information yet. So that was still up and coming, but everything was still like, you had the CDs with the booklets as well, and then read text. And I was super fascinated by how that went. And then I also realized, I can't do this anymore. Like, I can't just keep eating meat anymore now. Like, I need to change my behavior as well. And then there was a bit of peer pressure as well, because that's the context where you are. Like, everyone, or at least most people there, and people you respect, that you really admire, these lead singers, and they tell you to go vegetarian or go vegan. That sounds reasonable. Then you read about it. I probably should, because this is not right. And then with this other personal experience I had with seeing chickens being slaughtered and bunnies being slaughtered, this is the tipping point for me. This is really where I need to take a stand and again, question prior beliefs and questioning prior traditions. And that's where when I became vegetarian, again, another kind of moment where I had to have that conversation with my parents. It's like, that wasn't super easy, but I was pretty stubborn about it. And at first they didn't really went along with it in the first few weeks, but quickly it changed. Like, and then they became super supportive. My mom said, I have no idea how this is working. And back in the days, this is more than 20 years ago, there was not that much products available at the moment. Yeah. It was a bit harder to get your information in the first place, but also to feed yourself as vegetarian, and that makes it tasty and everything.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Things have changed that quickly.
Yeah. And so I created a whole list of products. Like, I was not well informed at that stage. I just knew something was wrong. I just wanted to do it. And I haven't thought the practical aspects of it very much through. And I need to also help my mom here to prepare and cook for me. And I also learned to cook myself throughout that journey as well. So I still love cooking. And then when I went to university, I became vegan, because that's the other paradox that was still there. There was a lot about eating meat, and there's a lot about slaughterhouses for meat consumption. And then, but what about dairy industry? What about, like, why are people vegan instead of vegetarian? And trying to convince yourself, animals are not getting killed by drinking milk, until you start also informing yourself on that topic and the egg industry. We probably should be a bit more consistent. If you believe that animals should not suffer, you should refrain from eating any animal products, because it's just horrible. And more animals are being killed in the dairy and egg industry almost than in the meat industry. That was a bit more tricky to change my behavior as well, because it's such a, again, normal, nice thing to eat and to do. It's just that required a bit more discipline there. While I never had any problem for meat or anything, it was a bit more tricky to stop eating, I don't know, cake and desserts and all. Drinking milk was not a problem. Eating raw eggs or prepared eggs was not a problem. Like, that was easy, but it's where all these products are basically end products and biscuits and everything. But we got there.
And you mentioned there was some peer pressure from the bands and some aspects of the social groups you were part of as well. But did it feel like you were going quite naturally along with a flow with your friend group, or was most of your friend group still, you know, looking at you as though you were a bit weird?
There were quite a few friends, like the other friends that went with me to the concerts, and that was pretty big community then. And most of them became vegetarian and vegan at that time. And a lot of them still are, even though I'm not in touch with all of them anymore, but I'm pretty sure that most of, and then at the same time, we had this bigger activist movement where I used to live as well in Bruges and in Belgium, that made it very easy to go with that part of the movement as well. It was not just about going to shows. It was also showing up at demonstrations and doing your bit into really make a difference there and convince people.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Thank you. And one of the, even within the, I guess, the vegan and the animal advocacy movement, another challenging boundary for many people is wild animal suffering. My personal boundary includes all sentient beings, which includes animals in the wild. But for many people who are, you know, vegan or animal advocates, they and I will absolutely agree that we need to, you know, have a transition to end animal farming and fishing, for example. But there's something that stops them or makes them hesitant about engaging with the topic of wild animal suffering because it's part of nature. They're nervous about human hubris and intervention. What's your perspective on wild animals?
Yeah, I found it a very difficult question and I still keep thinking about it. I need to read more about it as well because I want to see different viewpoints on that. I think it's a very tricky one. I don't even know, like, from a practical point of view, then, like, you have the theoretical or ideological point of view that might support intervening in nature to reduce wild animal suffering. From a practical perspective, can be not even feasible to do anything. And it's like, is it worth having this discussion at this point when we already have like all these factory farms still need to address where we actually are the ones responsible for that? Shouldn't we not invest more attention to that rather than having part of our active community start focusing on these other debates that seems a lot more tricky? But again, I don't know enough about it to see how feasible that death might be. So people might completely disagree, have more knowledge about it. Like, but actually, we can already do some things to reduce wild animal suffering. Now, the tricky part also comes from, so I have no clear viewpoint of that. So I will not speak in favor of one or the other. I just try to make sense of it. And I've talked, and actually last week when I was giving a talk in the Netherlands, like online as well, someone asked me that as well. So put me to ask me that question. I know it's a big debate, and especially in effective altruism movement, that community, they go pretty extreme on those views as well. Not that there's a kind of overall agreement on it, but it's taking very seriously and it's getting more and more attention. But the thing is, like, intervening, or from that, how would you say, paternalistic point of view, like, we are the ones dominating, it's still establishing dominance over animals, that we all feel entitled to do what we want with those animals. And if we think they shouldn't behave the way they do, we can intervene there, even if it's causing or not causing suffering to other animals. So, because that's where I feel very conflicted about it. And I'm not sure it enforced that dominance, the human superiority belief anyway. And I don't want to support that belief, but at the same time, you do want to reduce animal suffering. And if you can, why would you not do it? So there is a bit of a paradox there.
Yeah.
The same way in the discussion after the talk last week was also about, we also talk about benevolent and hostile sexism, for instance. Like, on the one hand, we want to reduce both because we've shown in research that both have very negative effects on inequality generally and gender inequality. But benevolent sexism might be seen as something very positive because you want to be very protective towards women, but at the same time, it's a very paternalistic, dominant, male-dominant viewpoint, but it maintains gender inequality in so many ways that men are the ones who can actually decide what to do and how women should be treated. Sometimes in a bit more subtle way, but not in the way you want to support if you are against sexism or if you are against gender inequality. And that's where you can actually also find some parallels with what we want to do with animals or with nature, like the very interventionist perspective. Yeah, well, you do not recognize them as their own free thinking beings with their own personality and their own desires and motivations. If you want to constrain their freedom because you think they are harming other animals too much. So I find that a very difficult question as well.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a fascinating parallel, as you say. On the one hand, we have capabilities and therefore, you know, might be able to reduce suffering in certain ways, but there's also a danger of hubris and human arrogance and a sort of domination mindset that we should be very cautious of as well, given the interventions we've already made. And in a way, that's partly why I quite like this sentientist idea, because it cops out of all of the difficult decisions and trade-offs, right? It says there's loads of different ways of prioritizing different causes and justifying or not justifying certain different interventions, and whether farmed animals or wild animals are more important. And it backs away from all of those and says the important thing is that we include all sentient beings in our moral consideration. And you might still come to the conclusion that we should or we shouldn't intervene in wild animal suffering, but at the very least, you have to include them in your consideration. You have to. Whereas I think some people are so nervous of the idea of intervening in the wild that they will therefore exclude wild animal suffering completely from consideration. And I think that's a mistake. I think we at least need to consider it, recognize it's, you know, an important, their perspectives are as important as any, but still have deep humility about and be really prudent about how and whether we choose to intervene. It's a fascinating space and an immature space where we need to understand a great deal more.
Yeah, I also think there's not always a clear boundary what is considered wildlife and what is not. Right?
Yeah.
So it spills over into what your companion animals do outside the house, for instance. If you let your cat just chase birds and everything, like that's kind of wildlife that's being attached, but you are also partly responsible for taking care of your cat and make sure that your cat is not harming other animals too much in that way, or like trying to prevent that or keep. Yeah, some would say keep them indoors. I think for a number of cats, it's safe to let them outside, but also just make sure that other wildlife is safe there. At least for my cat, she's super slow. She wouldn't even be able to catch a bird anyway. So, and she has bells on her. So all birds would have like at least 10 minutes even to escape before she would get to them.
She's low threat.
Very low threat. Yeah. But then like these rescue programs rescue programs, I was going to that point first, that you have the animal sanctuaries, farm animal sanctuaries, but they sometimes is a mix of rescued wildlife as well. And then people bring them in and they take care of wounded pigeons or wounded foxes. That's where we also intervene and take care of wildlife, and I think that's a very good thing to do. But it's you would not start intervening to make it happen unless it's where our own human behavior has caused that suffering again, like with car accidents and all of that.
Yeah, and I agree. I think there's, on the one hand, we already intervene in the wild at a massive scale, so it's not a question of whether we intervene or not. We already are doing it. Let's at least try and find ways of causing less harm through those interventions. And while there are some super contentious ideas that you might have about whether we need to start feeding lions cultured meat or bioengineering to take predation out of the wild, right? There are also some much simpler, more basic, and much more safe and much more prudent ways of intervening or not intervening that, you know, are already being experimented with. So people are, one of the frustrating things is that as a human species, whenever we're thinking about wild animals and potentially conflicts of interests, our default answer always seems to be kill them all, right? So we jump to the idea of culling very quickly. But even in pragmatic terms, there's some things going on in the UK at the moment where people are starting to recognize that maybe, you know, we should use contraception instead of culling, or there are different prudent ways of intervening that might make sense. But regardless, let's at least ensure those sentient beings are included in our sphere of consideration. And the other thing that strikes me is the power of the categories that we use, whether it's companion animals, farmed animals, human, non-human, different species. And you can cut through all of that bullshit by considering the perspective of the individual sentient being itself. An animal doesn't know and doesn't care whether it's wild or invasive or vermin or farmed. It just has an experience that is good or bad. That can quite often, we need to remind ourselves these are categories we've created normally for our own purposes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's also where some of my research is focusing on. And it's kind of part of human nature or human behavior, human psychology to really categorize everything. And some categories do make sense, but others are completely socially constructed, self-serving, and based on the functions we have with animals, right? So that's where we compartmentalize animals in different categories, depending on the function we have and the relations we have and how we use them for our own needs. A lot of that do not make sense from a biological perspective or from more natural perspective. It's purely the social function these animals have towards us, which we created that gives them certain moral standards or not, or just, or we strip them away from their moral value. And that leads to a number of other psychological kind of tricks that we use to keep them there as low as they are, or like farm animals, or what we call best animals, or that type of.
Agree. And I think there's a lot of value in a maybe what might be described as relational approaches that recognize the different natures of relationships between different entities and different beings and how those shape the way we think and maybe the way we should think. But there's also a risk in those relational ways of thinking as well, because it's normally the people with the power that are defining the nature of the relation. If we decide our relationship to those pigs is that they are farmed animals, their purpose is to feed us, and that's the relation we've defined, it can justify awful suffering. So it's worth remembering who has the power in defining the relations.
Yeah, that's true. But I think the power is with the humans, but it's so, like, it's hard to pinpoint it to one single factor, right? Like we have these historical traditions, cultural norms, and then the whole economy is very powerful and have, of course, they don't want us to change anything because it would lead to bad things for them, because they would lose money and they don't want anything to change. So they are super motivated to hide all of that and then to keep that narrative going that farmed animals should not be considered animals, but should be considered as food or as products that we own and that we can do what we want with them.
And I want to come back to that, but before we come on to that question of, how do we, in given that context, how do we make things better? There's another challenge to a sentientist or a sentiocentric view. One is, look, you're going too far. Humans matter most, or humans are the only things that matter. But the other challenge goes the other way and says sentientism is too restrictive. It's not broad enough. And actually, maybe we should have a biocentric or an ecocentric perspective that grants direct moral consideration to plants and rocks and rivers and ecosystems and Gaia and those wider concepts as well. I'd be interested in your perspective on that. Are you open-minded about even more generous moral consideration, or do you think sentience is the right place to draw a line?
I must say I've stopped thinking too much about these questions. Like I would say 10 years ago, I was like really feeling I need to take a viewpoint here as well. Do we go from a biocentric perspective where everything that is alive and can be defined as or falls within the category of animals? That's where we can actually grant personhood to and more value to these kind of individual living beings. Or do we need to consider ecosystems? And that's still different from rivers and rocks and a single plant, right? The ecosystems where all these kind of species are living in. But then I always come back to what is it of value to those individuals again. So my perspective is always that kind of, it's about the individual value of a living being. And I've never really would say that rivers or rocks has the inherent value in the same way as an individual living being that I consider living being, the animals or sentient living beings, I must specify, because of course plants are alive as well. But and I value ecosystems, plants, rivers in different ways, and I can't justify it the same way as with sentient living beings. So I don't recognize that they would suffer in the same way or that they be aware in the same way, but I'm definitely open-minded to attribute some value to that. But and also when you cut down a tree, it has implications for the animals who are living in that tree. So from my reasoning, always come back to how much harm does it cause for the ones living in there. And then where it becomes a bit more blurry is about what's the inherent value of the tree as well. If it's, I feel, and that might not be so rational, or if it's a very old tree and everyone has trees they like as well, and they've been always there in the street or in the park or in the forest that you walk. And then some trees seem a lot more valuable for some reason, like the big ones, or like really aggressive ones. Yeah, you can't just cut those down, even though, of course, trees should not just be cut down. It always needs a bit of consideration, like whether because of just environmental reasons, but then not every tree seems to be as valuable in terms of what they provide. And some seem to inflict a bit more respect and admiration for that as well.
And I think I have a very similar view in that I think non-sentient entities and systems can be deeply important, but that I think they're instrumentally important because of their impact on sentient beings. But that doesn't just mean cold ecosystem services. As you say, the tree isn't just about a place for the birds to live or an environment that helps things survive, it also has this aesthetic importance as well to non-humans and to human animals. And that's also deeply valuable. So some people who go to a sort of biocentric or ecocentric point of view are nervous that sentientism will just see the environment as a sort of cold provider of services. And that's not the case at all, because it has a much richer impact on all aspects of sentient experience as well. But one of my particular bugbears is the people who, and I guess the central gravity of the modern environmental movement tends to do this, which is because of an anthropocentric concern about climate change and environmental destruction, they will then grant moral consideration in a way very generously to the entire of the environment, while still conveniently carving out consideration for farmed animals and most wild animals, so that most environmentalists are more ready to grant rights to rivers and mountains than they are to a pig or a cow or a chicken. So that's one frustration. In a way, I'm quite comfortable if people want to think about biocentrism or ecocentrism, but don't forget the sentient beings, right? So
yeah, exactly.
We're worried about homicide, and now people are worried about ecocide, but no one ever talks about senticide, right? There's no concept for the taking of a sentient life.
That's exactly my view as well. I'm okay with going a long way with the ecocentric perspective for a number of reasons, for environmental reasons, for respecting nature and everything else. But it starts to become sometimes problematic when people are only talking about species conservation, like it's all about the species in itself, and biodiversity is important for a number of reasons. But what about the individuals within those ecosystems? And like, that's, you can't forget those. And it's not just about cutting away the undesired individuals there, or like when they overpopulate, according to your own views. Basically, this is kind of, the world is populate with so many humans as well. Like, it doesn't seem right just to let's reduce the world population now just by killing a number of humans because they're causing trouble and they're polluting everything. And
I find that's a fascinating check. I don't necessarily think that all sentient beings have exactly the same moral worth or value, right? I'm open to the idea that you might grade those in different ways, and different sentientists will disagree about how to do that and whether to do that. Some have a more egalitarian approach. But I think it's a really interesting check. If you take anyone's ethics about non-human animals and say, how would that work if you applied it to human animals? It's quite often a very stark, stark and awful story. Malthusian population culling, or the ethics of farming human toddlers because they might have a net positive life. You can end up with some very unpleasant ethics, in trying to justify how we treat non-humans.
Yeah, most people are not ready to have that conversation.
Yeah,
or kind of would just not have it. Like, just would stop there because you're making parallels that, according to them, are absurd.
Yeah,
even though they're completely rational, because they are based on the same principles and trying to show where the inconsistency in the reasoning is. But that seems to be happening all the time when we think about animals. We're not thinking straight about animals. We're thinking like in a very distorted way and a very biased way that always ends up in like very negative for the animals themselves, just to be able to justify our own behaviors and our beliefs about it.
And that brings us quite neatly onto the final section of the conversation, really, which is about the future. I like to try and encourage my guests to take a sort of positive utopian cast and say, if you can imagine a world where people are more generously compassionate and maybe they have a more naturalistic understanding of reality grounded in reality, what could that future look like for human ethics, for non-human ethics, for the world as a whole? But also, the more difficult question is, and how do we get there? And your work is central to addressing that. So those are the two questions, really. What could that more compassionate future look like? And what's the best way of getting there, given how weird us humans are and our psychology?
Yeah, those are the big questions that we struggle with, right? Like, how to do it and what is the best way to achieve that future in the fastest possible way. And it seems all super complicated because there's so many levels, systems in place that just prevents change. Social change is always very slow. And it seems to be harder than a number of other social justice issues that have changed over the year, but haven't disappeared at all on all levels yet. But we're dealing with a much more substantial problem that seems to be very hard to tackle because it's systemic at societal levels, but also deeply psychological, that we refuse to acknowledge that there's a problem. But not vegans, of course, but like generally on average, everything seems to go against finding ways to change people. Yeah. At the same time, you see gradual changes in people's opinions about animals, that they value them a lot more. So there's always a bit of optimism there as well. People are disturbed about factory farms now. You see in polling results as well, like people do not really support these practices in principle. But in practice, of course, they do, because they still buy their meat from, most meat is coming from factory farms.
Yeah, almost feels like there's a latent ethics you can tap into, because most people don't want to needlessly cause non-human animal suffering or human animal suffering.
Yeah, and that's where all these psychological tricks are kicking in as well. Like we avoid it, we don't want to see it, we don't want to be exposed to that kind of paradox and to that dissonance that we feel when we would be realized that we're harming animals with our behaviors. And even when you're exposed to it, you open up to all kinds of justification strategies and rationalizations to make it look okay, or we deny the mind of the animals that we eat, like, even though that make zero sense. Even like, why would a mammal like a pig, we know that they are smarter, usually smarter than dogs, and we find intelligence information very important to make moral judgments as well. If you would ask in principle to people, do you think it's important to consider intelligence level or cognitive or even suffering levels valuable to know when you make a moral judgment about a certain individual or a certain animal? They would all say, yeah, of course. You need to consider like cognitive capacities, suffering capacities, because that prevents you to do harm to them. But then if you make it very specific about food animals, they'll throw that overboard and no, it's food, it's fine. So all of a sudden we strip them away of their cognitive capacities, we strip them away from the suffering capacities, like the sentience information, or we just deny that information was ever given, misremember it, process it differently than the same information if it would be applied to companion animals. Just that kind of how people think about animals is just not thinking straight. And there's a big self-serving factor underlying that. Like, they don't want to be the ones realizing, actually, I came to that conclusion, so therefore I need to change my behavior. So I need to refrain from my favorite dishes, need to refrain from all these family traditions that shapes our community or society. It's part of their identity.
There's so many levels. Yeah.
There's so many levels. And then there's also the whole masculinity norms about it as well. If it's even worse for men than to be realizing that, because it's part of, again, the masculine identity that if you need to be, and these kind of stories and myths about it, that you need to have meat to be strong and healthy. Like, there's a lot to deal with there that is not, I would say, easy when you reason about it that way, but in itself, becoming vegan has never been so easy before. Not everywhere, I would still recognize, probably not everywhere, but at least in the UK, I would say this, or in Western European countries, it's so easy to shift, to go to supermarket and buy vegan products now and find tasty, delicious vegan products. But even in that evaluation, and that's coming out from our work as well, people see, judge, evaluate it differently just because they can't recognize that, they are reluctant to recognize that vegan food can be nice and tasty, because it would make it one of the excuses that they use, that it's necessary to eat meat or it's not invalid again. So we know it's invalid because there's no scientific proof anyway that it's necessary to stay alive. In fact, it's the contrary, right? It's much, there's a number of health benefits with veganism. And all the dietary organizations already recognize that vegan lifestyle is completely appropriate in all life cycles, like stages in life. So it's,
So given all of those layers and the fact that there's so much inertia around driving that change, what do you think are the most effective ways of making change happen? I know that's a tricky question, because on the one hand, we should just tell people the facts and the light will go on, and doesn't really work.
That's the type of question that we want to address with some of our research, right? Like, we want to get to know a lot more about that, what works and what doesn't. The animal rights movement is not a very young movement anymore, and we're still at the same like place where we were 20 years ago. Sometimes it feels like that, very pessimistic, that there's almost no change is happening. Levels of meat consumption is going up worldwide and all of that. It's like it, sometimes if you realize that, what are we doing? Are we doing it right or are we not doing it right? And so trying to come up with scientific evidence of what works and what not is highly needed. And there are a lot of opinions going on in the animal rights movement and different camps, like how to do it. And usually people do not have clear evidence for their claims. So that's where we need to start putting out these intervention studies, work with the organizations that are actually doing these campaigns and see if it works or not in the most scientifically possible way. There's always a lot of noise involved when you do intervention studies because you can't have it all under control. So if you find effects or no effects of your intervention, you still haven't had full control over what's going on. So it could be a number of different factors that have made it successful or unsuccessful. But that's where we are at the moment. And I don't think there's one effective way of doing advocacy. Yeah. I do think like a number of people would say or would agree that providing information about what's going on and try to make people think about it is a very effective way. But then that's easier said than done because you need to have people being in the right moment context to process that information honestly as well.
Yeah.
And it's not always the case. Like if it's kind of information on Facebook or social media or information on TV, it's very easy to just to look away from it. It's easy to just not wanting to see the facts. It's easy to distort the facts or to attribute wrong intentions to the messenger. Yeah, they are animal rights activists, so it's not true. They like we have all this way of dealing with information as well that just make sure that you can sustain your current habits. But if you have a normal conversation with someone, which is not practically not possible for every single human on the planet, but that's where you can have kind of a clear, constructive, informative conversation about what's going on. And that seems to be working pretty well, where people are already open to have that discussion in a very, well, it has to be in a very constructive and not defensive way, not like inducing guilt and shame into that, because that can also work differently with different people. They shut down or feel that they're being accused of being immoral and then get all these moral reproach effects that has been documented in psychological research, that they react very defensively against the person talking to you in a way that increase anti-vegan bias, for instance, or increase the like even pushing them even more away from what you actually want to achieve, it's about not just communicating. In fact, it's about how you communicate it and where these people are in their journey of realizing it and trying to tailor that to different people. Then there's a lot to be said about creating the right context for it as well, making it even more easy. Even though it's very easy, it's still to go to the shop and make those decisions. Can be made even more easy by making it even more accessible or increasing the number of plant-based products as well. And that's where, I guess, people coming from a more economic perspective would be interested in, like, increasing sales of product. And that's a very capitalist idea again. But yeah, this is working within the system, even though I personally believe we need a whole paradigm shift from an ideological point of view. We need to rethink society completely. And I've never changed that view since I was 15 years old. But
yeah,
from a pragmatic perspective, we can make some changes within the dominant system to actually improve things as well. And that's really trying to find out what works to push people more towards buying more vegan products as well, making it also trying to lower the barriers there and like also their defense mechanism, to making them more open, see what types of labeling works, see how you need to present these products, your dishes, your food. And there needs to be a push from political systems as well. Having like politicians caring about animals and about vegan food is critical to facilitate policy changes as well. So it needs to come from the whole dynamic between at individual level and kind of grassroots level, enough people want to facilitate change in the right direction, usually from an ethical perspective, not just from a health or a environmental perspective, at least a lot of gaps otherwise, like to really come to a proper understanding of what we're doing to animals. We need to recognize them, that they are living sentient beings. But then there needs to be politicians at the same level, or people in important positions that in companies or in schools that also can make it a lot easier to change, make policy changes that actually are either make veganism a lot easier within their context, within their organizations, within their regions or cities, or that, but also communicate kind of new norms towards the population. If you know that kind of installing norms can shift when actually there's political will there, when they make it a bit more vocal, like really talking about veganism at several levels really helps, I think. And
yeah,
I think that's, I pressed a bit from the question what is effective, but there's a lot needed there to facilitate actual change.
I think there's the theme that comes through your answer is that the systems we're all part of, whether it's individual psychology, social setting, institutional structures, you know, capitalist organization, governance, law, it is all built up and has this inertia. So it feels like we almost need to pull all of those different levers all at once to, if we really want to make a shift. Just individual behaviors by themselves won't be enough. But of course, all of those institutions are made up of individuals. So as individuals,
exactly, we
can take consumption decisions, but we can also vote. We can stand for office. We can write a letter to a company. We are employees or shareholders or directors, and can pull those institutional levers as well. And it is difficult because you mentioned before, in many other sort of human social change movements, they also felt very slow. But if you look back on them historically, certain things have changed quickly. None of them are fixed, and there's so much more to do. But if you think about some of the other human social change movements, you don't have to go back many decades to find a situation
exactly,
that was, I think, very clearly worse than it is now. So if I'm never quite sure whether we're at a sort of similar tipping point with non-human ethics.
I like comparing those struggles, and we can learn a lot from other social change movements. And as we know that they're all interconnected anyway, because it's about like how you think about the world and about values and just broadening that scope. So there's some fundamental similarities there between different social justice issues. But at the same time, the thing with animals is that like they are so deeply ingrained in our culture, in our practices, in our traditions, and in what we do, in our habits, that they are just ending up as products that we eat. And that's a whole new layer that was not in other social change movements. So there are important differences that we need to keep in mind as well, and that we need to tackle it probably with different, in a different way.
Because if you look at post the Second World War, most countries signed up to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which we know how many problems there are in human discrimination and human ethics and poverty and global health, and there's still awful things going on and war and so on. But at least conceptually, at that point, most governments of the entire world acknowledged that needlessly causing suffering and death to any human, regardless of any characteristic, is a moral negative. And we're a long way from even achieving that conceptual agreement for non-humans,
at
least for humans, we have that concept that we can try and work towards. With non-humans, we don't have that concept agreed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's still that problem with kind of the gap between principle and practice for human rights as well, to move towards more just society. But in principle, we're not there yet for the animals, even though most people feel it's wrong to harm animals. They will not grant animal rights to just on the spot like that.
And when you look, I've been lucky enough to talk to some amazing people in the animal rights and the animal law professions who are working to change this. But if you actually look at animal law at the moment, my last guest said it's more a tool for oppression. It's like a weapon against animals. It's there to, as part of the structure that justifies catastrophic torture and killing, right? That's not what animal law is, you would think, is about.
Yeah,
at the moment, that's what it is, right?
Yeah, and in those laws, there's a lot that doesn't make any sense anyway. Like some animals are excluded for being recognized as an animal in the first place. Like farm animals are getting different like kind of legislations because they are excluded from all kinds of animal protection laws. And then, that's nonsensical to me. That doesn't
sound right. There's much to dismantle.
And the same way mice and rats that are used for laboratory research, these are not seen as animals. They are not recognized. And these are seen as just as goods, as products to be used for that purpose. So they are being, in a lot of these legislation, they are being excluded from animal protection legislation. So it's very weird how that weird. It's a very protective system, like you said. It's actually a tool to keep going how we're doing, like to keep doing to keep oppressing animals more than help them. There's a lot to be said to protect companion animals, and but at the same time, there's a lot of paradoxes there as well. Because then all of a sudden, we do not, in some countries, we do not recognize the dogs the same way as other dogs, like depending on dog breeds. And again, that's complete psychology and social perception of certain dog breeds that are seen as more dangerous, even though that's not always, there's a lot of nonsense going on there in that discussion as well. Yeah, it's and it's just all through our biased perceptions of between different types of dogs as well there. So
And we've spent, and part of the sentientist agenda, understandably, I think, focuses on non-humans just because that disconnect is so stark. But it's interesting because I do think a sentientist perspective, like a humanist perspective, also has a lot to say about human discrimination and human suffering as well. And we're animals too, right? And in the same way as humanism rejects all forms of human discrimination, so does sentientism, because it says the only thing that we should be using to qualify humans morally is their sentience. And we all have sentience. Again, it's a quite egalitarian cast. But some people will challenge the non-human animal agenda and say, look, we've got so much work still to do just within the human species with racism, sexism, homophobia, you know, all of the monstrous problems we're still working on, that it doesn't make sense to focus on non-humans yet. My personal view is that actually there's a positive knock-on to human ethics by improving our degree of compassion for non-humans as well. But how would you respond to that challenge? And I guess as part of your vision for the future, what do you think the future might look like for intra-human ethics as well?
Yeah, because I didn't really answer that part of the question about how the future would look like. No, but I completely agree with, if we improve the life of animals and like lifting the moral status of animals to a higher level, it should have positive knock-on effects on human intergroup relations and all these other social justice domains. And there's a bit of research showing that can actually happen because think about how we use animals in our language and how we portray other humans as animals as well. Sometimes you see like the animalistic dehumanization of other groups.
Objectification
and so on, stripping them away from essential like capacities that we do with farm animals as well. And if we would lift the status of animals to a higher level, it would completely take away the whole idea of animalistically dehumanizing humans as well. Like it would not make sense anymore. So we would at least also respect human beings in at least the same way. But that comes with also that problem that people, if they are motivated by outgroup prejudice and they want to keep discriminatory systems in place, they will be motivated to keep animals at the lowest levels, because they realize the implications. And some people are more socially dominant or support inequality a lot more and have kind of interest to have economic inequality. If you would change that for animals, they get very nervous because they quickly realize, oh my God, if we're doing it for animals, then I will lose all my privilege towards other human groups as well, like my privileged position and like my dominant position in society. So there's also that intergroup dynamic going on, that people are actually also don't want to value animals that much because they realize the consequences for human intergroup relations. In my own view, it's all interconnected, and that's how I imagine the future to go through. We see it's gradual change is a bit occurring, even though it's in practice, it doesn't come out that well, but at least in people's beliefs and attitudes, there seems to be a change is happening toward a more just society, even though there's a number of factors trying to prevent that and makes it go a lot more slower than it could be by denying that discrimination exists in the first place and by denying that animals are worthy of or more consideration. But it doesn't make any sense to me to put like these different social justice issues in different categories. Like that you can't just focus on, well, practically you can't focus on one, but you not care about any of the others as well.
Yeah.
I know some people do that and people have these kind of involvements in different movement and don't care about the other movement. And then one of your questions was like, yeah, we need to focus on these human social justice issues first. And but you get that a lot from meat eaters as a strategy. Like, yeah. What about this? What about that? What about should not care about, like, and you see that in all the time about social justice issues and between human groups as well.
Yeah.
Like, why would we care about third world problems if we can't solve problems in our own country first? Why should we care about that? It's just a way to completely take away any motivation and action to do, really. Yeah. It just leads to nowhere. And I don't think it's always honestly motivated by honest concern about the issue that you're raising. It's more about just to invalidate and deactivate and like demotivate people to engage in any of the other problems.
I think that's often the case. And while in some situations there are really difficult trade-offs and decisions we have to take, many of these things aren't trade-offs at all, right? We can do both. And many of these solutions we're talking about, these more compassionate solutions we're talking about, are a win for everybody, right? They're a win for non-human animals. They're a win for human animals. They're a win for the environment. So many people are pretending there's a trade-off when actually there isn't a trade-off at all. It should be a pretty obvious win-win for all concerned.
Yeah, this kind of zero-sum beliefs is a very common psychological strategy like that. If we do that, we will lose out on that. Or another kind of thing that we need to take care of is going to be disadvantaged by focusing on that. But I don't think that's true anyway. I mean, the thing with animals is completely not true, because if you, like, how far can you get, like, in recognizing animal rights as some one of the most important social issues that our times is struggling with? If we can fix this, like, this so much more will be fixed because of that as well. It flows from there that everything that is a problem at the slightly lower, if you can get people on board with animal rights, you should be getting them on board with all kinds of human rights and get that right as well.
I agree.
And I don't think, but in theory, that's how I see it. And I do know that in practice that you see people also in the movement of animal rights do not care too much about these human rights as they should be, or they don't value the other struggle, social justice issues that much, or think they are not worthy of their attention. Animal rights are hugely benefit having a bit more vocal, a bit more outspoken about, like, also, and it's changing a bit, but tackling the other social justice issues as well, and be more inclusive on all fronts, and definitely condemn sexism within the movement, which is just still a huge problem. But if we can make that right already, then this kind of makes the movement bigger and more, will be more respected as well from the outside.
I agree. And I think one of the themes there is that we need to remind people in the animal advocacy movement that humans are animals too. Humans are also sentient beings. And if we're genuinely going to have universal compassion for all sentient beings, that includes having compassion for other humans. And maybe most difficult is to have compassion even for the humans that are continuing to cause catastrophic suffering to non-humans, right? Because we see the harm, we see the ethics, it is something horrific. And it's very easy to then become judgmental and to withdraw our compassion from other humans. And you'll see it, you know, people will talk about humans being the virus. I can understand that. I can understand the emotion and I share the emotion. But if we want to be genuinely universally compassionate, we have to have compassion for those people too. They were indoctrinated, as were we, into thinking this was normal. We need to remember that and be understanding, partly because I think it's a richer grounding for our ethics is to have universal compassion, but also, to your point, it's more effective in our communications and our persuasion and our trying to change the systems too.
I get that point as well, like that we need that kind of universe approach to make sense of our ethical belief system, because it doesn't, like, it's incoherent to have it for animals but not for humans who are actually animals. And then when you ask people, of course we are all animals, so that's why we actually care about other animals in the first place. Like, this kind of, that kind of circular reasoning otherwise behind it, that you would push other social justice issue because they focus on humans outside the scope of your attention or activism for this kind of ideological reason. But at the same time, you turn to animals in the first place because you recognize that they are sentient beings and want to be actively involved in fighting for animal rights, because you believe that humans are animals and animals have the same kind of, at least the basics that grant them the, that you think why they should be attribute more rights and more consideration.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does. And that's partly why it brings it full circle around to this grounding that for me, ultimately, this capacity to have experiences, to suffer and flourish is the grounding of all moral value. And that ultimately is leads me to the radical ethical stance that needlessly causing suffering and death is a bad thing. But if only more people would agree. But I'm very aware I've taken up loads of your time. It's been it's been a fascinating, inspiring conversation, and hopefully we can keep moving towards a more just, compassionate world. And if there's one thing that we need to do better to make that happen, it's to develop a much richer understanding of the strange animal that is the Homo sapiens. And your research is absolutely invaluable and central to that. So thank you. Fascinating work. And what's the best way of people following you, learning about your work, reading your book? I can include links in the show notes, of course.
Definitely read my book.
Why We Love and Exploit Animals.
Exactly, why we love and exploit animals, and bridging insights from academia and activism and advocacy, really. And with the book, it's not written by myself entirely. I wrote a few chapters in it and co-wrote a few chapters, but we have a number of different perspectives in this. So we wanted to provide a very rich kind of context there from sociology, from critical animal studies, but also like largely from psychology and social psychology. But we also let animal advocates provide their opinion and beliefs there. And some of it is less scientifically grounded there, but it's good to have these opinions and make us think about what can we now take away from that and actually study to validate or invalidate these kind of approaches. So that's what we wanted to bring together. And I think that's the same approach we have for the animal advocacy conference that we are organizing. It's online now, end of June, first 2 days of July, where we want to bring people together from the social sciences and behavioral sciences to present their work on meat consumption, our perceptions of animals, and also bring in advocates to listen to these talks and communicate with us and have that open conversation about what can we do to help each other and to learn about human behaviors towards animals. It's unfortunate that we have to do it online because of the pandemic, because on campus and within the room, it would open up a lot more opportunities to collaborate actively and to come up with new ideas. It's not something like that will be easily achieved online, but there's a lot of excitement about it. And a lot of people are joining and there will be tons of speakers already. So that's good. So you can find my book on Amazon or on the publisher Routledge. You can also find the conference website if you're interested. If people are interested, can sign up as or register as a non-academic students or advocates and activists. And then the website from our research lab is Shark Lab, that you probably will put in the links there. So you can learn more about that as well and find more publications, academic publications. And we also wrote a few more accessible texts that are more for a broader audience as well. What we also want to achieve with the book is that we didn't want to make it an academic book at all. So we want to really have kind of a broad audience that would appeal to, and the book should appeal to a broader audience than the more typical academic books that are being published, which is mostly research focused then. But our book is really opening conversation, should be readable and accessible for everyone that is interested in the topics. And I think that's where we need to move towards. We need to have, indeed, that's where we start our conversation about the scholar activist approach, strongly in critical animal studies, but in psychology that has been mostly focused on sexism and racism and these kind of social justice issues, coming up with intervention strategies to reduce these social problems. But now it's kind of time to do that on animals as well, and on speciesism, and trying to understand what's going wrong with us. Why do we do the things we do towards animals, and why most people don't feel okay with that, but still doing it. So then coming up with ways to address that and test interventions and campaigns, whether some campaigns are actually effective or not, or even counterproductive. So that's indeed our vision, our mission, our goal with Shark Lab, is to tap into all these different research areas.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Thank you. Academic and activist, and hopefully helping make the world a better place.
Yeah, thank you for having me on the podcast.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
It's been super interesting. I already forgot half of what I've said, but I think I need to listen to myself afterwards.
Well, it's been a privilege to hear your personal story and to discuss these critical topics with you now. So, yeah, thank you, Christoph.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening. You're helping to normalize rational, compassionate thinking. Don't forget to subscribe, leave us some stars or a review. You can visit sentientism.info to find out more, and you'd be very welcome in any of our online community groups. The biggest is on Facebook. If you like what we're doing, why not tell your friends about us?